Welcome. We'll start our 10:30 session. So this is going to be aerodigestive management of the syndromic patient. So we have one panelist virtual, two live. So we're going to go through trisomy 21 charge and then 22 Q11 deletion syndromes. So I just want to introduce our panelists. Super happy to have everyone here. So Claire Richardson is one of our ENT docs coming here from Phoenix. We have Sarah Zach coming from Cincinnati. She's our pediatric pulmonologist. And then Philip Nolman is our peds ENT coming from Cincinnati. So we're going to start with Dr. Nolman. He's going to go over trisomy 21. And then I just pulled one slide together real quick. I think a lot of the literature I kind of briefly looked at talked about multidisciplinary management being so helpful. And obviously us coming from Arrow would totally agree with that. Here at Children's, we do have a multidisciplinary plan or kind of medical home for our trisomy 21 patients. It's called the C Center. They meet very frequently. We have a huge population of kids, and their multidisciplinary approach really is developmental peds, pulmonary, SLP, OT, PT, psychology, and social work. We actually don't have a charge MDC clinic here, but we do have a 22Q. They see patients about once to twice a year, so it's kind of just an annual management. It's really run by genetics, but they also have immunology, ENT, OT, SLP, developmental peds, and audiology. So it's kind of been our approach. And I will let Dr. Nolman get started.
Hey, I'll do a mic check real quick. Can everybody in the room hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. And then I'll share my screen. Just give me a heads up if that's is looking okay on your end. All right. Is that looking okay?
Looks good.
Okay, perfect. Well, I appreciate y'all letting me join virtually today. If there's anyone in the room that knows me, they know I like to ramble on when it comes to talking about kids with Down syndrome. So if I get a little long, somebody give me a warning. But I'm happy to be able to join you all from Cincinnati and present aerodigestive evaluation in our infants and children with Down syndrome. A couple of quick learning objectives, at least for this portion. We're looking to understand the prevalence and impact of aerodigestive disorders in this patient population. And then it provides some understanding for the rationale for guideline-based evaluation and care, which oftentimes is multidisciplinary in nature. So start with a quick case presentation. This is my buddy BG. So I first met him as a two-month-old. So he's a two-month-old with Down syndrome. And when I met him, he had recently been admitted for bronchiolitis, but found that at baseline, he had had some difficulty with feeding and failure to thrive as well. Some baseline symptoms included, you know, no stridor while awake, but had some mild stertor and some intermittent stridor with sleep. And as he recovered from his viral illness, video swallow study was completed and showed that he did have silent aspiration with liquids across all consistencies. There was delayed initiation of swallow and some NP reflux present as well. Also completed a sleep study early on in infancy that had shown severe obstructive sleep apnea with an obstructive index of 52. His oxygen saturation nadir was 84%. Thankfully, we didn't see any evidence of hypoventilation. So for initial management, a nasogastric tube was placed to help with some safe enteral feeding because despite some early modifications, we weren't able to get him feeding without aspiration and not gaining weight well. So NG tube went in. And then for his obstruction, he was titrated on a quarter liter of supplemental oxygen, which it worked fairly well, but he still had persistent severe sleep apnea despite it. His obstructive index was just around 10. We had performed flexible nasal laryngoscopy as part of his early evaluation, and it showed very clear evidence of laryngomalacia. And so a multidisciplinary aerodigestive evaluation was recommended for him. He went back to the operating room not long after so that we could do a flexible bronchoscopy, MLMB, and EGD. And because where I live and work, MLBs are sort of central to that. So these are the representative pictures that I'll show you. So on his exam, very clear from left to right that he had obvious evidence of severe laryngomalacia with that omega-shaped epiglottis, the foreshortened AE folds. And though on the static image, it doesn't show a retinoid prolapse there with our dynamic imaging, we did find that the prolapse or arytenoids did prolapse on the left side a little more than the right side and obstruct the posterior glottis. Vocal cords were nice and normal and crisp. We had proven on his flexible scope awake that he had normal vocal fold mobility. Subglottis right there in the middle, it's showing you an elliptical cricoid, so slightly narrow from side to side. Not much in the way of true stenosis, but as most kids with Down syndrome, he's sized about half a size smaller than we would see in an individual of the same age without Down syndrome. And then as you get down to the bottom of his trachea, you can see a branch of that tracheal bronchus off to the right side. On the flexible bronchoscopy, he didn't have any other abnormal branching patterns. And thankfully, he didn't have any significant signs of bronchitis or early sequelae of aspiration at that time. And then on the final picture on the right, we check at the back of the voice box to see if there's evidence of a cleft, but his intra-arytenoid space looked okay. All right, so transition into some background. We see these kids really commonly, and we see their aerodigestive issues very commonly as well. Down syndrome is a common chromosomal abnormality. There's an incidence of 1 in 700 births, and so for people like us, we see them frequently come through our clinics and our operating rooms. Their presentation is commonly associated with various otolaryngologic disease, pulmonary disease, GI manifestations of disease. And this can include upper and lower airway anomalies, upper airway obstructions, severe sleep apnea in many cases, swallowing dysfunction. The impact of these things is quite significant on their comorbid developmental delays, can be associated with reduced quality of life and increased risk of disease in the long term as well. And so an improved understanding of this is oftentimes associated with improved evaluation of these patients, management of these patients, and the overall clinical outcomes. For airway anomalies specifically, there's a high prevalence of upper and lower airway abnormalities that we do see in these patients. Like our patient BG, laryngomalacia is very common, as is tracheobronchomalacia. Many of these cases tend to be associated with a history of congenital cardiac disease as well. They tend to have a smaller subglottic and tracheal diameter, again, compared to age-matched peers without Down syndrome, and that can have implications for airway management. So this is a study that was published 23 years ago that looked at endotracheal tube sizing in patients with Down syndrome compared to controls without Down syndrome, and in general, they size about a half to one size smaller. So being cognizant of this is very helpful when it comes to airway management in the operating room. Subglottic stenosis may be more common in this patient population as well, but that increased likelihood, a bit of an uncertainty if it's due to congenital stenosis in many cases, or if it's acquired stenosis because of need for early intubation, especially among our kids that have concurrent cardiac abnormalities that require repair. Congenital tracheal stenosis may be a bit more common as well, and there's some prior studies on small series that show an increase likelihood of complete tracheal rings in this patient population as well. As a means of demonstrating this, so I'll go through a few studies through the literature that we have. Many of these things are based off of retrospective reviews and relatively small case series. This is one of those. This looked at 24 children with Down syndrome that had presented for bronchoscopy. So it's a selected patient population. They're already coming in with a need for an airway evaluation. Median age around 11 months. And the indications for that evaluation included presentations with stridor, atelectasis of the right upper lobe, or recurrent pneumonias. They did compare their group of patients with Down syndrome to a cohort of 324 patients without, who had also undergone airway evaluation. And what you see in the table on the right is that there is an increased prevalence of things like laryngomalacia in 50% of the patients, tracheomalacia and bronchomalacia. Tracheal bronchus was seen as an incidental finding in many of these, and a pretty small proportion of no structural abnormalities found. So that last arrow points out that a quarter of patients didn't have any significant findings. And when you look at it compared to the control group, most of these prevalences seem to be much higher in our patients with Down syndrome. The other striking thing tends to be the case that multiple airway anomalies are commonly found as well. So in almost half the children with Down syndrome in this group, they had more than one airway pathology or finding that was significant. This is another review now of 65 patients with Down syndrome, slightly older median age. They also had undergone endoscopic evaluations for things like recurrent respiratory infections, chronic cough, and stridor. Rate of normal exam only in about 30% again, so fairly consistent there. And again, seeing higher rates of things like laryngomalacia and tracheobronchomalacia. Subglottic stenosis was seen in 3% of patients. And again, multiple airway anomalies seen in about 20%. Again, our relative prevalences are much higher compared to age-matched peers in that control group without Down syndrome. Again, those two studies looked at selected patient populations. They all came in for a specific reason. So this study aimed to trying to find the true prevalence of some of these airway disorders among a more general population of patients with Down syndrome. So this group looked at a birth cohort of 240 children with Down syndrome over a 20-year period. Of that birth cohort, 39 children, so 16%, had an airway evaluation completed, again, for similar indications like stridor, failed extubation, recurrent croup. And when you looked at the overall birth cohort, about 13%, 14% had at least one pathologic finding in their airway. They found a maybe smaller overall prevalence of laryngomalacia as compared to the other studies, but they still found things like subglottic stenosis, laryngomalacia, tracheobronchomalacia. And of note, the significant portion of the patients that did present with need for MLB ended up needing intervention as well to manage those airway issues. So supraglottoplasty occurred in a couple of patients, laryngeal cleft repair, tracheotomy in 6, and LTP in 2. So not only are we finding frequent airway abnormalities, but there's need for intervention for those as well. As mentioned, laryngomalacia seems to be one of the more common things that we look at. So we'll dig into this a little more specifically. It's, of course, the most common congenital anomaly of the larynx that we see, and it's associated with a collapse of the supraglottic structures, specifically during inspiration. In general, it can have a variable presentation, including things like stridor, apnea, cyanosis, respiratory distress, upper airway obstruction, sleep apnea, feeding difficulties, and failure to thrive. And depending on the severity of that presentation, we make recommendations for various management. In patients with Down syndrome, it ends up being the most common cause of upper airway obstruction in children under 2 years of age. As kids get older, it becomes a little less prevalent and a little less symptomatic. But when considering patients with Down syndrome and these presentations or even a known diagnosis of laryngomalacia, then an airway evaluation should be considered, or at least have a lower threshold to consider, you know, an aerodigestive evaluation, even in those patients, given the higher likelihood of secondary airway anomalies or the impacts of that laryngomalacia on things like their swallow function and sleep. In mild to moderate laryngomalacia, we tend to see that it resolves with growth in time. And that's true in about 80 to 90% of all patients. The conservative measures could be something as simple as observation and watchful waiting in clinical follow-up. Oftentimes, we'll consider medical management of concurrent reflux disease, as there's been some studies that show an association between those things. Feeding modifications can commonly be used in kids that have feeding difficulties as well. And then supplemental oxygen, as in our case with BG, can be helpful in some cases where there's a significant degree of upper airway obstruction that is responsive to oxygen. For patients with severe disease, we tend to consider things like supraglottoplasties, and they're generally safe and well-tolerated. They can be very effective. And you tend to see significant improvements in things like breathing, feeding, and growth. But there are failures or risks associated with this as well. In the general population, the failure rate is about, you know, 10 to 20%. And these failures can be anything from lack of improvement in symptoms to need for revision surgeries or other interventions. You can see complications in these patients as well. Failure rates tend to be elevated among young infants, so less than 2 months old, those with a history of prematurity, genetic syndromes like Down syndrome, cardiac disease, neurologic disorders, and secondary airway lesions. And though I hate to show this slide, I mean, this is what a complication or a failure from a supraglottoplasty has the potential to look like, right? So thankfully, this isn't my buddy BG, but this is another patient with Down syndrome who had quite unexpected supraglottic changes from an otherwise uneventful supraglottoplasty that led to downstream effects of more significant airway obstruction and need for tracheotomy. So it's at least worth noting that there are some presentations that don't always head in the direction that we anticipate. When we look at supraglottoplasty as an intervention for patients with Down syndrome specifically, you know, we do see a slight difference in terms of maybe some complication rates and failure rates in this population compared to a general population, but it's still quite a safe and effective approach. So in this retrospective review of a small number, 18 children with Down syndrome, who presented with laryngomalacia and those indications, there was improvement in symptoms in nearly all patients. So out of 16 evaluable patients that followed up, there was improvement in 16 out of 16, and feeding improved in the vast majority as well, but they did note surgical failure in about 33%. And again, that included some patients with lack of symptom improvement, patients that needed a tracheotomy for persistent airway obstruction, G-tube placement for persistent feeding difficulties, or need for revision supraglottoplasty. And their postoperative complication rate was about 16%. So back to BG, my buddy BG. So given his evidence of significant laryngomalacia, his swallowing dysfunction, persistent severe sleep apnea despite oxygen, a supraglottoplasty was ultimately recommended for him. And he went from sort of this appearance at the beginning of our procedure to a more open appearance here. So during the course of a supraglottoplasty, we're dividing the AE folds and oftentimes removing some of the redundancy over the arytenoids, which you can see was completed on the left side, and it gave us a more unobstructed view of his upper airway, which was good. And ultimately, this last picture was taken a number of months later when he had indications for another look in the operating room, but we see that things healed pretty well in his case. When he came back at 6 months of age, so 4 months postoperatively, he had some persistent symptoms of mild intermittent stridor and sleep disruption. He did have a period in time where he had some mild supraglottic edema, some intermittent prolapse of the right arytenoid of the posterior glottis. So some of these mild symptoms were attributable to that. We completed a postoperative sleep study in this case, and it did show significant improvement, but some moderate persistent obstructive sleep apnea. So he went from an obstructive index of 52 down to 7, which is a really nice result. And his feeding difficulties were slowly improving, but on his follow-up video swallow study, some aspiration events did still persist. And so rather than keep an NG tube in for long term, a G tube was ultimately placed to help support his enteral feeding. With his subsequent evaluation, again, we sort of hone in more on this idea of multidisciplinary care for these patients as well. We completed a FEES exam along with our speech and swallow team. It did show good vocal cord mobility. He had good secretion management, but he was still showing some difficulties with his swallow mechanics overall. So there was some oral phase bolus transfer difficulty. He did have a timely swallow response with small boluses, but it deteriorated with higher volumes and thinner liquids, and still had that mild delay with thin liquids. But thankfully, we weren't seeing any aspiration or penetration, obviously, on the FEES exam. And he was starting to tolerate small volumes of purees pretty well. So at this point, he continues to work with the feeding team, the SLP team, and occupational therapy to make progress with oral motor skills. He's accepting more oral intake at this point in time, but volumes are still limited because he tends to have signs of congestion and stridor after higher volume feeds. Transitions in pretty well to a discussion of swallowing dysfunction among this patient population as well. So as we find, dysphagia and aspiration tend to be common across all age groups in our patients with Down syndrome. It's particularly true amongst infants with Down syndrome in that 0 to 12-month range. The estimated prevalence is about 30 to 80%. There appears to be an increased likelihood of silent aspiration among these patients as well. Contributors can be both anatomic and physiologic. Things like upper airway obstruction, like we've talked about, laryngomalacia, as we've seen in our case so far. See laryngeal clefts in these patients, just like we do in other patients. Complete tracheal rings can be found in some of these patients. And then from a GI perspective, there may be some increased prevalence of esophageal motor dysfunction. And in some small series, we've seen perhaps an increase in risk or prevalence of achalasia as well. Those tend to be in slightly older patients with Down syndrome. Other physiologic function or factors can be things like reflux disease, that generalized hypotonia that we see in Down syndrome, reduced oral motor function, reduced sensory motor skills, and developmental delays as well. And the associated sequelae can be significant, right? So failure to thrive in our young infants, growth delays over the course of time, recurrent pneumonias, and chronic pulmonary disease are all things that we should keep in mind as impetus for evaluating and treating these things very consistently. Going back to the literature a little bit to kind of bring these points home, this is, again, retrospective reviews, a slightly greater number of patients in these. But of 174 infants that presented to this specialty consultation clinic, 100 were actually referred for a video swallow study based on clinical concerns. And those could include things like we talked about, poor growth, failure to thrive, so on and so forth. And a large percentage of these patients did have evidence of some type of dysphagia. So 55% with either oral or pharyngeal or both. 40% ended up with recommendations for an alteration in the consistencies they were taking, or even recommendations for strict NPO based on the severity of some of their presentations. And what they found is that there was an increased risk of dysphagia among those that were presenting with airway or respiratory abnormalities, and also among infants that had desaturation with feeds as sort of an isolated symptom presentation. And another study, this is looking at 127 infants with Down syndrome, again, a range of about a week of life up to a year. Many of them had already come in on a modified diet or had needed an NG tube. Many had come in with prior pneumonias. And they found high rates of dysphagia, oral dysphagia, 90%, pharyngeal dysphagia, 72%, and aspiration in 30%. But striking is the notion that among those, many of them have what would be considered silent aspiration. So no specific sort of like cough or gag or choke, eye watering, redness, any of those signs that we typically look for in kids that are aspirating. So they don't show a lot of those signs, but there are some other subtle clues for these patients that indicate a need for those evaluations. So high rates of silent aspiration. And some of the associated factors that they found were associations with prematurity and associations with prior need for NG tube placement, which makes sense. Another retrospective review, again, this is just sort of hammering home this, the same ideas, the common themes. In this group that they looked at, high rates of dysphagia, and again, really high rates of aspiration among those that were aspirating. And then finally, looking at sort of what that progress looks like in these patients over the course of time. So this is looking at 200 children. And the big takeaways from a study like this is not just the high rates of dysphagia that we see or the comorbid conditions that tend to be associated with them, but the fact that this is dysphagia that can persist over the course of time, even at a pretty decent length of follow-up. So many of these patients required some sort of modification or intervention. And at the time of their follow-up analysis, when the mean age was about 7, 8 years old, 80% still had some persistent dysphagia there. So it's not just a thing to evaluate in infancy and expect that we're going to get a very clear-cut outcome right off the bat, but something that we continue to follow closely, again, in that multidisciplinary way. Given the body of evidence that we have, there are some guidelines that are published mostly from I guess the context that's provided by ENT, pulmonary, and GI studies, but this is from the American Academy of Pediatrics' most recent update on their health supervision guidelines for children with Down syndrome. And when it comes to swallowing dysfunction specifically, the guidelines are suggesting that any patient should be referred for a radiographic swallowing assessment if they show these signs. And again, some of them are related specifically to swallowing signs and symptoms that we can see, but many of them aren't. So if we're seeing, you know, subtle signs of, you know, slow feeding or desaturations with feeds, recurrent pneumonias, failure to thrive, poor growth rates, then those are all kids that we should be thinking about evaluating early on. Okay, come back to BG again. So now we see him at 15 months old, and clinically he's doing pretty well. His primary nutrition is still via the G2, but his oral intake continues to improve with therapy. Thankfully, we haven't seen him in the hospital a lot with episodes of pneumonia. Still has some intermittent noisy breathing, so stridor, but just with increased activity for mom and dad, and no increased worker breathing, thankfully. But he does still have a bit of snoring at night. He's been restless with sleep. Follow-up sleep study continues to show improvement in sleep apnea over time, though, which is good. So now he's down to sort of borderline mild to moderate persistent sleep apnea with an obstructive index of 5 and a saturation nadir of 92%. And thankfully, we were able to wean him off of oxygen as a result of that. So he's heading in the right direction. And that's my transition to this sort of final part of the talk, and that's obstructive sleep apnea. Now, this is a topic that deserves, you know, full lectures unto themselves, and I'm sure there are many of them out there. But we'll go over some of the high points of obstructive sleep apnea in our patients with Down syndrome briefly. We see obstructive sleep apnea not uncommonly in all the kids that come in through our clinics, right? So about 3% of the general pediatric population overall. But In our patients with Down syndrome specifically, that rate is significantly higher. So depending on the review that you read, the prevalence may be somewhere between 30 and 80%. And there's multiple predisposing factors to this, right? We've talked about laryngomalacia as in our case of my buddy BG, but as kids get older, you see more related to adenotonsillar hypertrophy, can be associated with midface and mandibular hypoplasia, relative macroglossia and glossoptosis commonly, generalized hypotonia. So these are kids that, you know, when we're evaluating them, sometimes we're coming back with comments saying we're seeing multi-level airway obstruction, and some of it's just due to the collapse at the level of the pharynx or hypopharynx. And then as kids get older, we should be more cognizant of the fact that BMI plays into that as well. So obesity can be a common trait. There are long-term adverse effects of untreated sleep apnea. These include neurocognitive developmental effects, effects on quality of life. You can have strain on the heart and the lungs over time with untreated sleep apnea. So pulmonary hypertension and cor pulmonale are sort of like end stages of pretty severe untreated sleep apnea. One, I think, really fascinating thing about this patient population and what, again, provides impetus for the way in which we should think about their evaluation is that there's a really low predictive value for the presence of obstructive sleep apnea just based on parental reporting of symptoms. So they're not always the kids that come in where parents can say they're very restless sleepers, they're snoring, they're gasping, they're choking in their sleep, they're waking frequently, they're not doing their best during the day. Sometimes they can be completely asymptomatic patients, but still we have a high level of concern for potential underlying sleep apnea. So the gold standard for diagnosis is the sleep study. This is, again, a study that kind of has shown that point to us. This was done by Dr. Schott about 20 years ago now. And while amongst a group of patients that have high rates of sleep apnea, she found that the sensitivity and specificity of parental reported symptoms or parent reported symptoms were quite low. And so as a result of that type of finding, there are, again, published guidelines for how we should think about this patient population from infancy through childhood and how we should evaluate this patient population. So for our kids that are young from, you know, 1 to 5 years of age, not only should we be asking about sleep symptoms at their visits when they come, but we should be obtaining a sleep study as a screening measure if symptoms haven't been the driver of that before. We should do that at least at the age of 3 to 5 years. As they get older, continue to discuss obesity as a risk factor for sleep apnea. And then some newer guideline recommendations that come into play in this iteration of the publication was related to checking ferritin and starting iron supplementation if they do have sleep symptoms, particularly restless sleep symptoms. And then as our patients get older, age out of childhood and into adolescence and young adulthood, we should continue to discuss sleep apnea because we find that there's epochs across their lifespan where they may be more likely to present with sleep apnea as well. When we identify these patients with Down syndrome, it's important to think about the strategies that we have for treatment. You know, BG presents one example where you can consider supplemental oxygen, which can be both effective and pretty well tolerated in infancy. There's a certain point at which, practically speaking, our patients don't tolerate it so well or don't keep it on so well. But in infancy, it can be really helpful. But you do have to monitor for things like hypoventilation as a consequence of oxygen supplementation in some of these patients. Supraglottoplasty, as we've seen in our example, can be of benefit. Many improve, but we still have patients that have a need for supplemental oxygen even after surgical intervention. As we get a little bit older and see persistent sleep apnea or new onset sleep apnea, we can talk about medications in the cases of mild sleep apnea, so Flonase, and you know, I think previously we used Singulair a little more frequently than we do now, but they've been shown in studies to be beneficial for managing upper airway obstruction. And then adenotonsillectomy becomes something that's very highly considered, again, as kids age out of infancy. It tends to be the first line treatment that we think about. But again, in this population, there's a higher likelihood of persistent OSA even after surgical treatment there. The alternatives to surgical intervention, or if there's persistent sleep apnea after surgical intervention, we oftentimes think about CPAP. So again, we bring in this multidisciplinary sort of approach to these patients. CPAP can be very effective and very well tolerated. those are great discussions to have with those families in clinic when they share concerns, just like, you know, parents of other pediatric patients, that CPAP might not be well tolerated. It's been shown to be perfectly well tolerated in a lot of patients, but it does require some good resources to be able to provide those patients and families in order for those patients to use it really well. And then there's additional surgical management options that can be offered, you know, pending airway evaluations in patients with persistent, you know, significant sleep apnea. So we'll look for things like recurrent adenoids. And we've seen recurrent adenoid hypertrophy in maybe 60% of cases where they've already been removed. And then we have additional evaluations like sleep endoscopy and CineMRI to help us identify levels of obstruction that may be potential targets for intervention. So sleep endoscopy and CineMRI tend to find things like macroglossia or glossoptosis in a high percentage of patients, recurrent adenoids, large lingual tonsils, hypopharyngeal collapse. And depending on those collapse patterns or obstructive patterns and the types of structures that we see, we can, again, provide an integrated multidisciplinary approach to how we continue to manage those patients from infancy onward, right? And again, I won't belabor the point. It's for another topic in another day or another time in another lecture, but you know, the surgical options that we have available are things like inferior turbinate reductions and revision adenoidectomies, lateral expansion pharyngoplasties, plenty of tongue-based surgeries, hypoglossal nerve stimulators becoming more common and very effective in those patients as well, hyoid suspensions, craniofacial surgery. So lots of potential options, not to belabor the point. So we've talked about airway anomalies, swallowing dysfunction, sleep apnea as sort of these common presentations. So we sort of come to the end. This is at least where we're at with BG right now. Still doing well, still has plenty of error digestive issues that we're continuing to follow and manage, but they're evolving over the course of time. These issues are commonly encountered as we care for our infants and children with Down syndrome. And given the potential impacts of those issues on their overall health, their development, and their quality of life, it's important for us to remain vigilant, look for those subtle signs and symptoms that they may present with as indicators for, you know, further evaluation and further treatment, and maintain a low threshold for evaluating and treating these patients. And most importantly, engage our colleagues in an integrated and multidisciplinary approach to how we care for them. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Nolman. That was great. I actually had one question, if sure. That's okay with everyone. Maybe it's even more for the audience. You know, the data you were presenting on dysphagia and the rates of it, as well as the likelihood that it's actually going to be silent aspiration if they do have aspiration. You know, from a GI perspective, it's really clear in the guidelines we screen these kids for celiac, and you're presenting data that we screen for OSA in the toddlers. And I know, you know, screening for thyroid and all these things I think of that actually probably have a lower likelihood of incidents that we're catching. Why are we not making a VFSS like standard of care for all these kids? I'm surprised that that's not part of the AAP guidelines.
It's a great question. And I agree. And I've talked to my colleagues and mentors about it in the past. I don't know if it requires more, evidence. I think there's a good body of evidence already, but it's something that I think should be considered. And this is where the approach that we take for these patients can be, you know, that step beyond the guidelines as well. So I know most of these kids are coming in through our specialty clinics as it is, whether it's through ENT, GI, or pulmonary at institutions like ours. And I think we all sort of share that common thought in mind that many of them will end up with video swallow studies anyway. But you're right, if there's no evidence of signs or symptoms to base it off of, I wonder if there would be rationale to be doing video swallow studies as standard, even in the completely asymptomatic patient. You just have to weigh that against that small risk related to, you know, providing radiation to an asymptomatic patient and the consequence right. of making intervention recommendations based off of an asymptomatic patient with some findings, let's say subtle findings, right? But it's definitely worth considering.
There's a question in the chat
For you, Phil, about wondering your recommendation numbers of revision supraglottoplasty and recurrent symptoms in those kids.
Gosh, that's tough. I don't know that I can say that I have a recommendation for the number of times you try. Everybody's a little more individualized in terms of that. So BG, for example, right? He ended up getting a revision supraglottoplasty because we found that that right arytenoid was prolapsing. And so we were able to make a very directed treatment that seems to have been beneficial to him. I think when it comes to making those decisions, it has to be based off of objective data. So, you know, in my practice, that's based a lot on obstructive sleep symptoms or obstructive sleep apnea that's not being completely managed or treated in some other way. It's also sort of worth keeping in mind that at least anecdotally, we don't have, you know, published literature that speaks to this, but anecdotally, we do find that that hypotonia of the larynx can persist into older ages than you would anticipate in patients without Down syndrome. And so there are some patients with Down syndrome and sleep state laryngomalacia that we're still considering things like supraglottoplasty, and even as they get into later childhood and adolescence. So I don't know that I have a specific answer in terms of the number of times you try or the number of times you're allowed to fail, but if it's the area of obstruction and there's a specific target that you can go after, then it might be worth considering.
All right, any other questions or anything on the chat? Okay, perfect.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Dr. Nolman. All right. Okay, we're going to have Dr. Zach present. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having me. I am, like Sarah said at the beginning, I'm a pulmonologist in Cincinnati and part of the Aerodigestive Center. We have a charge center that's sort of embedded within Aero, a little bit separate because they have some other considerations that they think about as well. That's been in place since about 2015. And we see anywhere between 20 to 30 new charge patients every year and about 175 new and return visits each year. So lots of these kids. And just as a quick refresher, charge is typically associated with CHD7 mutations, but all stands for a different finding. So coloboma, congenital heart defects, choanal atresia, growth retardation and development, genital and or urinary malformations, and ear malformations. It's certainly a spectrum of disease. So some kids will have some aspects of this, but not all of them. And then in aerodigestive, we're specifically worried about airway abnormalities, so obstruction, aspiration, feeding difficulties, and how that impacts the pulmonary system, and then sleep concerns. And so that's what I will primarily focus on this morning. And, you know, all of these are generally multifactorial. There's not one specific thing that drives each symptom for these patients. And so try to sort through some of those things. So from an airway standpoint, these kids can have and often do have obstruction at multiple levels. So starting from the nose all the way down into the lower airways. And this can really create issues when you head to the OR if you're not prepared to deal with them. You can imagine if kids are having trouble breathing because of airway obstruction, this can contribute to multiple other problems. They don't feed well. They can aspirate things into their lungs. And then, like we just heard from Dr. Nolman, from a Down syndrome standpoint, lots of sleep concerns. Starting at the top, the nose, choanal atresia is present in 50 to 60% of charge patients, can be unilateral or bilateral. Presents a problem in infancy as babies are obligate nose breathers. And so bilateral tends to be more emergent. These patients will end up intubated, may need a tracheostomy tube if they're not able to be repaired in a timely manner. And then you can also have adenoid hypertrophy. And unlike some of our other patients, the adenoids are really there from birth and then grow between 3 and 6 months of age. And they continue to grow until these kids are really that preschool school age. In the nose and the throat, there's cleft lip and palate that we can see in about 25% of kids. And this can create feeding difficulties. You can have problems with mask seal under anesthesia. The tongue can fall backwards, obstruct the airway. You see in this bottom image here, just varying levels of obstruction just from the tongue base itself. And then just like adenoids, you can have big tonsils as well. And so all of these can contribute to obstructive breathing and difficulty on induction and under anesthesia. I think the biggest thing that we see in charge fairly consistently is what we call the charge larynx. So they tend to have a very classic appearing voice box. We see enough charge that if we walk into the OR and see this picture here up on the screen during a scope, we say, oh, that's a chargy larynx. And so what that looks like is really prominent, bulky, anteriorly rotated arytenoids that really crowd the glottis. You don't get that great view of those vocal cords. You can have short AE folds, and so everything is just really kind of squeezed together. And it can create a dynamic obstruction. And so this is a flexible bronchoscopy of a patient with charge syndrome. And you can see those really anteriorly rotated arytenoids, you don't get the great view of the posterior vocal cords. And as she is breathing, you see that dynamic obstruction over the glottis. And the inclination is to want to do a supraglottoplasty for these kids, but it doesn't respond the same as congenital laryngomalacia does. And so we typically don't recommend supraglottoplasties for these kids. It can cause difficulties with intubation. You can imagine in this image here on direct laryngoscopy, you don't get that great view of the cords. And so it can be difficult to fully visualize it and make sure that tube is in the correct place. And they can also have a little bit of narrowing in their subglottis as well. And so when you take these kids to the OR, you need to be prepared to secure the airway through multiple different ways if you need to. You need to know if they're maskable. Can you place an LMA for these kids? And then having other equipment available. So having your ENT or anesthesia colleagues prepared with the laryngoscope, a rigid bronchoscope, but also having somebody that is comfortable with flexible intubation, whether that is your anesthesia team, pulmonary team, or ENT. In Cincinnati, that tends to be mostly the pulmonary team just because we have the most experience with that. In the lower airways, the tracheoesophageal fistula is present in about 15 to 20% of patients. They can have TEF, EA, or H-type fistulas. And so understanding where the patient is in that process, whether that's been repaired, and if you need to intubate the patient. So tube placement can be problematic at times. If they are unrepaired, your tube can slide right into that fistula and then you're not going to be ventilating the lungs. If it is repaired, you can slide right into that pouch and still not be ventilating very well. And so understanding where you are and what you're doing about it. And then just like any other kid with a tracheoesophageal fistula, there's a risk for recurrence or multiple fistulas. And so this is a patient with charge. She had a TE fistula. She came to us for feeding difficulties and recurrent pulmonary infections. And so we took her to the OR for her initial evaluation, and we are exploring her TEF pouch. And so we're just insufflating a little bit of oxygen with our flexible scope. You see that there's lots of kind of clear bubbly secretions within the pouch itself. And one thing that you're not catching on this video because we don't have audio on it is that as we're insufflating, we're hearing a lot of like belching, burping. Her stomach is becoming more distended. And so those are all clues that maybe there is a persistent fistula there. And so really just want to make sure that you are exploring the entire pouch to make sure that it is closed. And unfortunately for this patient, we were able to find a persistent fistula in her old pouch, which explained a lot of her symptoms. And so exploring and are now in the esophagus, and you'll see the lower esophageal sphincter momentarily. And so all the progress that she had made with oral feeds, we had to pause for her, which was unfortunate, but she is now doing well after repair. if they've had a fistula, we almost always see some residual tracheomalacia at the site of the fistula that can cause noisy breathing, recurrent croup, difficulty clearing secretions from the lungs themselves, which can then lead to mucosal inflammation, just increased secretion burden down in the lower airways. And that can also be caused by aspiration and feeding and secretion management difficulties as well. And so from an airway standpoint, just being reminded that airway pathology can and does occur at every level of the airway. And these kids typically have multiple levels of obstruction that may require a trach if they cannot be managed in other ways. And you can imagine if their breathing is not normal, you can have trouble feeding and swallowing. And so nearly all of these kids have some sort of feeding difficulty, whether that is just dysphagia, whether that's frank aspiration, do they need modifications to their diet, things like that. And it's really multifactorial. And we'll go through some of the reasons why that is. A lot of these kids don't grow well. And again, that is also likely to be multifactorial. They're working too hard to breathe. They may have other associated conditions like congenital heart disease that contributes to poor growth. But a good chunk of them do aspirate. And I think it's important to assume that they aspirate until proven otherwise. But the good news is that this tends to get better with time. And there are ways to manage things. With charge in general, you have lots of cranial nerve abnormalities. And so that contributes to just abnormal sensation in the larynx and pharynx. And so that typical passage of food doesn't respond to or respond the way that we would anticipate in normal children. They can have a weak suck. They can have abnormal chewing and swallowing. And then they can have a lot of oral secretions, poor secretion management, and they can drool pretty frequently. They also, like we already talked about, upper airway obstruction can be a big player in structural abnormalities for swallowing. And then remember, the H is congenital heart disease. And so these kids may have other findings that lead to feeding difficulties. So whether that's a vascular ring, vascular compression on their airway or esophagus, or if they've had surgery, do their vocal cords work normally? And so all things to consider when you're evaluating feeding for these patients. And then, like a lot of our other syndromic patients, just developmental delay, behavioral concerns that lead to feeding difficulties. So why do we care if they aspirate? I'm a pulmonologist, and so I care that things don't get where we don't want them to be. It can cause long-term damage to the lungs. It can really impact their quality of life. So kids can need frequent suctioning. They can have poor secretion management. They are noisy. They choke. They when parents take them out in public, like everybody looks at us because we're loud and we have all this stuff with us. And then over time, it can lead to recurrent pneumonias and parenchymal lung damage that then requires these kids to need to use oxygen or positive pressure and ventilation. So the lung works the best when it's not a digestive organ. So food in the lungs is generally not a good thing. And so how do we assess these kids? And so we typically, we'll bring them into our multidisciplinary clinic, just like everybody else is talking about here. So we have shared clinic visits with pulmonary and GI. We will do additional imaging. I think, learned that there's an under-recognized degree of pulmonary disease in these patients, and so are a little bit quicker to CT or get additional imaging for our charge kids, and then take them to the OR to do combined endoscopy with pulmonary doing a flexible bronch, ENT doing an MLMB, and then GI doing their EGD. And then we'll get some sort of swallowing assessment as well, whether that's a video swallow study, a FEES, or both. And so video swallow studies are really useful if they are taking enough by mouth. And so if they're not taking anything, you're not going to get much information from the study. And so you can look at how do they feed with various textures or consistencies, checking if there's aspiration with thickening. Can you position them differently? So chin tuck, making sure they're seated, things like that. And then different strategies such as drinking from a straw, an open cup, and ways to try and address aspiration from a medical standpoint. a FEES or a flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing can be really useful even if they're not taking enough by mouth. And so they, a flexible bronchoscope will go down the nose, sit in the larynx. We can look at vocal cord movement for these patients. We can assess their secretion management. Do we see aspiration? We can dye test a little bit in clinic. So put a little bit of green food coloring, blue food coloring on in their secretions and see what happens from that standpoint. And then we can dye test these kids at home. We can dye test what they eat or their secretions. So really only useful for patients with trachs to see if they are suctioning any stained secretions from their tracheostomy tube. So if they're eating by mouth, you can dye the food that they eat. If they are G-tube fed, you can dye their G-tube feeds and see what comes out. And then also their just saliva and their oral secretions. And if they are, you suction anything that is whatever color the food coloring is, then probably aspirating. Certainly if you suction food from the trach, I've had parents tell me they suction ravioli from the trach, they're aspirating as well. And over time, we can see some chronic lung damage. And so CTs are much more sensitive than chest x-rays in assessing the degree of parenchymal damage. And so the images on the right-hand side of the screen here show just varying degrees of damage. So in this top image here, you're starting to see some thickened bronchial walls, not true bronchiectasis just yet, but some subtle changes that may suggest that there's some chronic inflammation or infection down in the lungs. And then progressing over time to where in this bottom image here, you really, that whole left lower lobe is bronchiectatic and likely not participating in gas exchange. And our goal is to try and prevent bronchiectasis from occurring because once it does occur, it's really difficult to reverse and can lead to lots of morbidity and mortality for these patients. And so we're tending to do CTs generally at their first assessment with us, unless they've had one recently that we can evaluate the images on. And then how do we treat this? So depending on how bad their aspiration is, do they respond to any different strategies? We can get them in aggressive speech and feeding therapy to work with different techniques, different dietary modifications. A lot of these kids will still need tube feeds, both to decrease the degree of aspiration, but also to help them grow. And we know that time and growth helps pretty much everything for these patients. We have some medical therapies that can reduce your secretion burden in your saliva, and then also some lung protective strategies to help treat any bronchiectasis, but also to protect the lungs and prevent bronchiectasis from happening. And then a few surgical treatments as well. So medical management to decrease salivary production are things like glycopyrrolate, anticholinergics like a scopolamine patch, ipratropium, or atropine drops. And then Botox can be injected directly into the salivary glands to decrease that salivary production. And that's something that can be repeated over time if the patient has a good response to it. From a lung protection standpoint, it's really making sure that we're clearing the lungs of whatever's going down in there. So bronchodilators will help to open up the airways. We'll then use a mucolytic to thin out those secretions. We usually use either some combination of normal saline or 3% hypertonic saline, some sort of mechanical airway clearance to bring those secretions out, whether that's chest PT, a vest, cough assist, anything like that. We'll use azithromycin for our kids with chronic inflammation 3 times a week to address that for that anti-inflammatory effect. And then antibiotics can be really helpful as well, whether that's a cycled therapy if they grow a persistent bug or antibiotics to treat an acute on chronic or acute infection. And then surgical treatment is really indicated if none of those things work or if the family is like, Botox worked, but I don't want to keep putting my kid under anesthesia to do this. And so really the goal of surgical treatment is to decrease salivary production. And the main way that we do that is by procedures on the salivary glands. And I say we, thinking that I don't do any of these as pulmonologists, but work closely with our ENTs and interventional radiology to help us with this. So the drool is a bilateral submandibular gland excision and parotid duct ligation. Drool is much easier to say. And so basically go in, tie off the parotid glands in the cheeks, and then take out the submandibular glands below the jaw and let the remaining salivary glands pick up salivary production. Generally, it's pretty successful at decreasing that burden, or decreasing that secretion burden. Not always 100% successful in kind of getting them where we want them, but can be something that helps move them in the right direction. Certainly not without complications, just like anything else that we do. Dry mouth is probably the most common one that we see. And there's ways that we can modify the procedure if we need to, if that's a specific concern from the family, or if they're kind of that borderline, maybe they don't have a ton of secretions, but want to stop avoiding anesthesia or start avoiding anesthesia for Botox and things like that. So whether that's only tying off the parotids or only tying off one or leaving one of the submandibulars, ways that it can be modified a little bit. And then sleep. So, you know, like Phil talked about with Down syndrome, lots of sleep concerns in charge kids, both from a disruption of their circadian rhythm. So falling asleep, staying asleep. Do they have sleep disordered breathing, obstructive sleep apnea? Do they have central sleep apnea given their cranial nerve abnormalities? And then what does that sleep-wake transition look like? And so with the data that we have, we see obstructive sleep apnea in about 65 kids. And if we think back to all of the airway findings that we talked about earlier, those are likely contributing. It may not always be super easy to address just because there can be so many. And so different strategies, whether that's tracheostomy tube placement or oxygen or positive pressure, BiPAP or CPAP for these kids. But we do recommend that all of these kids have a sleep study at some point, especially if there are concerns, to make sure that we're not missing anything. And then depending on what the concerns are, if it's more of a circadian rhythm, a sleep behavior piece, then consider evaluation by a dedicated sleep specialist. And so just wrapping up, they're complicated. They have a lot going on. They often have complex airway issues that impact the rest of their care. And I think it's important to really assume that they may be a difficult intubation. They likely aspirate and they likely have sleep apnea until you have information for the patient that proves otherwise. And ideally, these kids are managed in that multidisciplinary setting, bringing everybody to the table to talk about what the best course of care is for each individual patient, because it is a spectrum of disease, and not everybody responds to the same things.
Awesome. Thank you. That was great. Just a question on just the logistics. How does that work, like the charge multidisciplinary within an aero group?
Yeah. So when we get a new referral, it'll say that there's charge syndrome on there. And so our aero coordinators will work with our charge center coordinators, and they're still here for their whole evaluation. We just kind of attack things on, like our ear center and things like that. So maybe here an extra day or two for their evaluation.
Okay. Do you guys try and cohort them to have, like, you know, the first day of the month or something? Or
it's weird to have a Wednesday when we don't have Wednesdays. Okay. Our OR day. Weird that we don't have a charge kid. So yeah. I think they're here pretty much every week.
Okay. Yeah. We don't have one here, and trying to think about, it seems like it would be helpful to have it in that multidisciplinary. I think they end up seeing a lot of people individually, and it's probably on the PCP, or we have a special care clinic, which is really sort of the primary PCP for these medically complex kids. But my sense is it probably falls on them to coordinate everything. All right. Other questions? Nothing in the chat. All right. We'll have Dr. Richardson come up and talk to us about 22Q.
All right. Last syndrome between you guys and lunch. I think my co-panelists have done a really amazing job kind of reiterating on these syndromic patients that multidisciplinary care, including aerodigestive care, is really important. So I'm not going to harp too much on that. Let me just tell you, it applies to 22Q also. So I'm going to focus more on some of the really specific things that you'll see with 22Q and how these kids are different from some of the other syndromic kids that we see. All right. So as the name suggests, it's a chromosomal deletion in 22q11.2, but for the purposes of this presentation, I'm just going to call it 22q. It's relatively common, occurring about once in every 4,000 live births. And previously, a lot of the spectrum of disease that falls under 22q was described as different conditions. All of these now fall under the spectrum of 22q, which just means a deletion on this chromosome, which causes issues with the formation of the pharyngeal arches. So this spectrum has a really, really wide range of presentation, depending on the penetrance of the condition, depending on the area of the genetic deletion. But overall, these are the most common things that we see with the 22q kids. So cardiac problems, most common is tetralogy of Fallot, VSD, ASD, and then vascular rings. I'm going to loop in that category too, because this is something that we see very commonly in kids with 22q. Immune deficiencies, usually related to thymic hypoplasia or aplasia, which can range from really minor, causing those recurrent respiratory infections and ear infections that we see in all of our clinics, to things like complete thymic aplasia and severe combined immunodeficiency syndrome. They also frequently have endocrinopathies, most commonly hypocalcemia related to parathyroid dysfunction or absence. Developmental delays across the spectrum, speech, motor, learning, all of those are very, very frequent in kids with 22q. They can also have renal abnormalities, ear and hearing abnormalities, which range from all sorts of things. It can be inner ear malformations and actual structural defects, to sensory neural hearing loss, to hearing loss related to recurrent infections. And then palate abnormalities are something that's very unique to this collection of kids and a reason why a lot of times they'll end up in ENT clinic or with our speech therapists. They can also have neurologic problems, most frequently seizures, and then feeding problems, which we're going to talk a lot about in this presentation. One thing I think that's really interesting to notice about 22q kids compared to other syndromes is a lot of times they're diagnosed later in life. The trisomy 21 kids are usually diagnosed pretty early, and the CHARGE kids as well, especially if they come out with a more severe phenotype, like with choanal atresia, oftentimes we're finding them in the NICU. This study came out of CHOP a couple of years ago, just looking at their 22q population. And what they found is that overall, the age of diagnosis is 3.9 years. And so this is kind of stratified between kids that present with congenital cardiac issues that need repair early in life. Those kids are obviously being found sooner versus the kids that don't have that cardiac disease are usually being found later in life. And so the takeaway point that I want you to get from this is that you might and probably are going to be seeing these kids in your clinics before you're seeing them in a multidisciplinary aerodigestive clinic. So keep that in mind. One of the reasons why I personally think that that is so important in this cohort is that you can't assume that a kid is going to come to see you and already has this diagnosis. So sometimes, especially in the ENT world, we'll be seeing them for very specific things like glottic webs or VPI or some of the things we'll talk about, and they don't actually have that diagnosis yet. And I think as a surgical subspecialist, it doesn't frequently cross my mind to recommend primary genetic testing other than for things like hearing loss, which we do regularly. And for some of you that are seeing these kids, it might not either, but I think we have to assume, you know, if a kid doesn't come to you already with a diagnosis and you're suspicious for it, don't assume that someone else has already recommended it or is going to do it. It's something that you should talk about with the family. And this can be an uncomfortable topic, I think, just because a lot of us probably don't do it that frequently. We're not used to, you know, proposing the idea that someone's kid may have a genetic syndrome, but this is something I've actually had to do a couple times over the last year with 22q specifically, because we're seeing these really unique things and recommending that they get it ruled out. And so, you know, every interaction that you have is going to be different with families. Some families are all about it, and others are going to be really hesitant. And some of the things that kind of I have found can be helpful in having this conversation is, you know, there's different ways you can go about it, but I think starting, you know, really generalized, you know, have a discussion about their family history, talk about, you know, things in overarching terms like, oh, you know, I see a lot of kids with these type of laryngeal abnormalities, and a lot of times they fall into this spectrum of genetic conditions, and kind of introduce the topic gently, and then, you know, offer genetic testing, but reiterate that it's optional. Not every family is going to want it, but it's important, because the sooner you diagnose it, the sooner you're ruling out other potential comorbidities that may affect the kid's life. So, you know, why do genetic testing? Why does it even matter if you know if the kid has this syndrome? Well, it can help you predict the natural history of what's going to happen over time. It can help you direct the workup. You can really prepare the family for different things. And then it can prevent certain complications in these patients. So you may be missing cardiac disease or other things like endocrine comorbidities that may be on the more mild end of the spectrum. Dysphagia and aspiration, which we'll see is pretty common in these kids if they haven't been worked up for that. You know, you want to make sure you're getting a really thorough history about that. You don't want to miss a hearing loss. All of these kids need to be screened for their hearing. And then they also have different anesthetic risks, just depending on what other comorbidities they have. So it's important to know about this before you intervene on things and make sure they don't get too far along in life, not being screened for them. The other thing that I think is important to keep in mind, like diagnosing a patient and getting that answer where you can kind of base all the other care around, can be really helpful for merging our goals, which are, you know, treating their medical problems, medically stabilizing them, and the family's goals, which are having a healthy kid that's at home without a bunch of devices and things like that. And so can help you figure out which treatment option is going to be the best for each particular patient. So I did a really unofficial cross-sectional poll of some of the audience members, just asking you guys questions yesterday about 22q patients, just because, you know, there's a lot of really specific ENT things that we see with them, but I wasn't quite sure, you know, how do they typically present to GI and pulmonary clinics? And so the answer to this poll was feeding problems with literally every single person I asked. And so I think that this is something that, you know, is really pertinent to every person in the room who's part of an ARO program. The literature on this is surprisingly lacking compared to these other syndromes that we've been talking about with trisomy 21 and CHARGE. There's all sorts of amazing studies. In 22q, when you search different results, you only get a couple relevant studies. And if you search aerodigestive in 22q, there's only 4 results and none of them have anything to do with multidisciplinary aerodigestive care. So, anyone want to collaborate on some 22q research? Let me know. These are the 2 studies that I think really did look at swallowing and dysphagia in 22q patients. And so the first study looked at 44 patients with 22q, all of whom got VFSS studies. And what they saw was overall, at least 90%+ of the patients had dysphagia. And so that was a combination of oral and oropharyngeal phase. At least 50% of them had penetration and about 40% had aspiration. And I think important to know is that 83% of that aspiration was silent. So these are patients that you want to keep in mind. A lot of times their aspiration, their dysphagia may not be as obvious as in some of the other kids that you see. There also was a relatively high proportion of kids with upper esophageal sphincter dysfunction, and a lot of them required G-tubes. And then looking at this other study, I didn't actually have access to it online, but overall what it said in the abstract was that looking at 75 patients, they saw that not just the dysphagia aspiration component, but a lot of the other coordination components were also abnormal. So the suck, swallow, breathe reflex, the oral transport pattern was also abnormal. And then this, you know, downstream led to issues with pharyngeal hypercontractility, cricopharyngeal dysfunction and diverticula and things like that. So I'm really kind of going over the whole spectrum of things that we may see in our different clinics for dysphagia. Now I'm just going to touch briefly kind of on each of our subspecialties, like what are the things that these kids are going to present to you individually with? So as we just mentioned, feeding is the main one. So a lot of the feeding therapists or speech therapists in the room, you may be seeing these kids before we are, for dysphagia symptoms. And so I kind of split that into feeding and dysphagia, which like we talked about is happens in about 90%+ of kids, and then speech issues, which are also really common in about 70% of kids with 22q. So remember, the feeding may range the whole spectrum from frank aspiration to things like oral aversion. Behavioral concerns for feeding are also really, really prevalent in this cohort. And a lot of that has to do with their developmental delays and things like that. And then speech concerns, I think, also is a very broad term for many different things that you guys might be seeing them for. So it could be for speech delay, or also for articulation concerns. And that could be related to structural abnormalities, such as their palate issues and their velopharyngeal insufficiency, which can cause not only speech stuff, but also nasopharyngeal reflux. Or you may be seeing them for specific voice concerns or hoarseness or voice quality problems. So really, like, kind of could be anything. From a GI standpoint, again, I couldn't find a lot of great data out there. The best I could find was that these kids have GI disorders about 65% of the time. And I think that's a really broad term for a wide range of diseases. Definitely the ones that were mentioned the most commonly in different articles were the ones, the first three on this list. So reflux, feeding problems, and esophageal dysmotility. But also keep in mind, they can have plenty of other anatomic issues too, like tracheoesophageal fistula, hernias, malrotation, and then other more vague things as well, like constipation. From a pulmonary standpoint, a lot of what the pulmonologist is going to see is going to be related to their feeding concerns and their aspiration. And so Dr. Zach presented that much more eloquently than I could have. So all of those things that she said apply to this cohort too. Another thing I wanted to point out, though, is that they may be presenting more on the allergy immunology spectrum from their underlying immunodeficiency. And so something to keep in mind is these kids may need a little bit more of that type of a workup than some of the other syndromic kids that you see. And then they also present for things like cough, sleep apnea, that sort of thing. Because I'm an otolaryngologist, I have a much longer list of things that we see them for in our clinic. And there are some really unique anatomic things that we'll touch on. So the most common thing that these kids get in terms of ENT things is hearing loss and recurrent otitis media. And so that's not to say you should be screening every kid with hearing loss for 22q, but if you do have a 22q kid, you should definitely be evaluating their ears. They can also have things like recurrent sinus infections or other types of head and neck infections. Their speech things may be something they're presenting to you for before they're seeing speech therapy. Sleep apnea happens in about 50% of patients, and it can sometimes be related to craniofacial things or their palate issues, but a lot of times it's just from adenotonsillar hypertrophy and the same thing that we see cause sleep apnea in other kids. The palate abnormalities that we see, which happen very frequently in this population, about 70% of the time, are things like a overt cleft palate or a submucous cleft, something that can even be as subtle as a bifid uvula. So that is a very common finding in the 22q population, which subsequently leads to some of their speech issues, especially to VPI. And then, as I mentioned earlier, they also sometimes can have voice concerns, and that's because an anterior glottic web is also a very classic finding for these patients, and I'll show you what that looks like in just a minute. They also have some airway abnormalities, which I'm going to tell you a little bit more about next. So I think in a 22q patient, you do have quite a big benefit from doing both an awake and an asleep evaluation of the airway. There's different things that you're looking for in each one. And so with the awake evaluation, you want to look at their nasal anatomy, you want to evaluate their adenoids, but you really, really want to get a good look at their velopharynx. And so you want to see if there's an overt or submucous cleft, you want to see if their velopharynx is closing, you want to do a VPI evaluation if the kid is old enough and can participate in it if you can. You also want to look at their carotid position, because very frequently their carotids can be more medialized than normal, and this can affect potential surgical planning in the future. You also want to look at other things that you're commonly looking for, like their tonsils, their tone, their supraglottic anatomy. You want to look for laryngomalacia. And then you want to look at their vocal folds. And again, if they're old enough and if you have the capability of doing that with video stroboscopy to get a good voice evaluation, I would recommend doing that as well. When they're asleep, you're going to be looking for some of the same things, but then you're also going to be looking at the lower airway as well. So sometimes you don't get a great awake exam of things like the palate and the carotid position, and so you can always do that with them asleep as well. You want to check for a laryngeal cleft. You also want to look specifically for the glottic web. Like I told you about, this happens about 20% of patients with 22q. Also important that about 30% of them will have subglottic stenosis, so keeping an eye out for that and considering sizing the airway when appropriate. You want to look at their mucosa, see if they have any signs of aspiration, look at their secretion burdens, evaluate for TEF, all the things that you're doing for your standard airway evals. And then also note that a high population of them are also going to have tracheobronchomalacia. So if you do have a suspicion for this, consider adding the specific evaluation for tracheobronchomalacia into your airway evaluation. And then, as always with any syndromic patient, it makes people feel better if you make a very specific plan for intubation and put that in your note also. So to touch very briefly on a couple of those ENT things that we see really commonly and show you guys what they look like. VPI, as I mentioned, is one of the things that we see most frequently 22q patients for. And this, on the other hand, as opposed to their swallowing dysfunction, is very, very well studied. There's over 200 articles about it in the literature. And we know that this happens for a variety of reasons, most commonly because they have a submucous cleft, but it can also be purely dysfunction of the levator veli palatini muscles. And then they also have just overall different palatal anatomy. Their velum can be really thin. Their pharyngeal depth, so the distance from their velum to their palate, can be just larger than in a normal patient. And then they can also develop compensatory techniques like velopharyngeal mislearning that can also contribute to their dysfunction. So I'm going to play this video that's just a really nice look in the back where you can see the abnormally oriented levator veli palatini muscles, and you can really obviously see that cleft that's happening there causing VPI. So because there's so many things that go into these kids' dysfunction, just know that they frequently will require not only speech therapy, but also surgical correction of their VPI, depending on how severe it is. The medialized carotid arteries, again, I'll show you a video of that I mentioned, are something to always keep in mind, especially from a surgical standpoint. Happens in about 25% of patients with this. And in just a second, you'll see the scope go back there. See that abnormal pulsation going all the way over across the midline of the pharynx. And so this is really important when we're thinking about different surgical procedures, especially procedures for VPI with these kids. So you need to know about this before you do a tonsillectomy or any sort of pharyngeal or palate surgery. And sometimes you have to plan a little bit differently for that. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about for ENT wise is glottic webs. And so remember, they're present in somewhere between 25% to 40% of kids with known 22q deletion. But if you see a kid that does not have that genetic diagnosis and you do see a web, 65% of those kids are going to have 22q. So this is where having that conversation about genetic testing can come up for the otolaryngologist. Also know that, you know, sometimes these webs can be really subtle. And so sometimes you don't see them awake and you really, your best opportunity for looking at them is asleep. So for example, this is a kid who's getting an MLB and this is his initial look as you're going down with your scope, looking into his subglottis. Overall, things look pretty normal other than some secretions. But then when you start getting your spreaders in to get a closer look, you can start seeing that glottic web. And it's very small and may not be of any consequence, but it's still important to know about as the kid gets older and starts vocalizing more. You should follow them long-term and just see when, you know, when they're older and when they're talking more, if it's affecting them. A lot of them don't require surgery. And I think doing a proper voice evaluation in these patients is an important thing when they're old enough to do one. So to summarize kind of the 22q things that we talked about, remember, it's a really heterogeneous condition. Like, you're not going to be every, you know, patient with 22q that you're seeing is going to be a little bit different, coming in with different symptoms. And chances are pretty high that you're going to be seeing them on your own before you're seeing them in a multidisciplinary clinic. And luckily, I think most tertiary institutions are realizing how important multidisciplinary care is in this patient population, starting to open 22q clinics, just like we have clinics for trisomy 21 in charge. It may present later in life. Genetic testing is important. Remember, feeding concerns are going to be your biggest issue to address and is really where the aerodigestive team can come in handy. And then once you diagnose 22q, you should really make sure they've been evaluated for the other potential manifestations of the disease. So keep an eye out for those. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. That was excellent. It really reminds me, like, as a sort of resident, I feel like we saw the really sick kids that were getting thymic transplants. And I think that was my thought process about what these 22Q kids look like. And I think in being an aero, I'm seeing these subtle kids. And we had a kid come through that it was so perfect. Your talk was excellent because it really highlights there was a kid who came through for dysphagia, term kid, feeding difficulties right off the bat, took him back for triple scopes. Dr. Prager said, you know, his carotid looks like it's a little bit not where it should be, maybe a subtle web. And we sent it, and sure enough, he had 22Q. So I think it's really good all of us in Aero be thinking about these. And I think even for me in GI, these could present with feeding dysfunction, just something to be really thinking about and screening for, since his cardiac disease was just aortic stenosis. So it didn't sort of initiate a big workup, but definitely stuff we should be thinking about and keeping in the back of our minds for feeding dysfunction NOS kids who come through Aero. All right, other questions?
Now, I just had a comment under causes for VPI too, iatrogenic, you know, those patients that come in with VPI that had an adenoidectomy or an adenotonsillectomy, and then you discover following on that's because it's 22Q.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point that was missing from my talk, is that if you don't recognize this kid as an underlying level of velar dysfunction, like weak muscles or abnormal movement, even if they don't have an obvious cleft and they get an adenoidectomy, they are more likely to get postoperative VPI than other kids.